It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday morning. This is the, the 13th of February 2020, and welcome to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. Really appreciate you all tuning in, and we have an interesting show lined up for you today. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about horses with a couple of folks. One is the head of the Vermont Horse Council, that's Heidi Krantz, and then we also have an animal science professor from the University of Vermont talking about the horse farms of Vermont, and we're going to talk a little bit, I think, about what kind of an economic impact the horse folks have in the state. There are a lot of good horse meets in the summertime, and of course, maybe it's not. We'll find out what they're up to in the wintertime as well. So we'll be checking in later in the program about all that. But first, we wanted to dig into one of the big news stories of the last couple of days. Really. I guess ranked second behind the New Hampshire primary, and that was the discussion about Roger Stone, longtime confidant of President Donald Trump, who was convicted in November of 7 counts. 5 of them were lying to investigators. He was also, I believe, witness tampering, and one other I'm not seeing right off the bat here, but a total of 7 in mid-November, he was getting ready for sentencing and is getting ready for sentencing. The Justice Department came out with a recommendation that he get 7 to 9 years in federal prison for his various crimes. And then the President of the United States weighed in with a tweet and said that he thought that sentence was way too harsh, that his good friend should not get 7 to 9 years, but something significantly less. And we want to focus on the questions about whether it's proper for a president of the United States to put his thumb on the scales of the criminal justice system to that degree. Presidents obviously have the pardon power, but whether they should be weighing in before sentencing in a criminal case, that's a new thing. That has not happened before, and we wanted to find out. Quite a number of people are pretty upset about it, and we wanted to find out why that would be and whether it's worthy of being upset about, or this is all just political noise, or exactly what's going on here. Wanted to bring in somebody who knows the Justice Department pretty darn well, has been an employee there in the past, and that would be Vermont's former U.S. Attorney Tristram Coffin. He served in that job in the earlier part of this last decade. He was appointed by President Obama to head up the Justice Department's presence in Vermont. And I believe Tristram Coffin, who's now working for a Burlington-based law firm, Downs Racklin Martin, is on the phone with us this morning. Is that true, Mr. Coffin?
Yes, I'm here, David. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me this morning. And I wanted to just check in with you first and find out a little bit about your own background with the U.S. Attorney's Office and your sense of what the rules are in terms of political involvement in the justice system. And so tell me, you joined the Justice Department in what, 2011?
I was a line federal prosecutor, career appointed DOJ employee for 12 years, mm-hmm. beginning in 1994, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I was a line federal prosecutor handling all kinds of criminal cases and a lot of civil cases as well, before I went to did a stint in private practice for a while. And then I came back to the Justice Department in 2011 as the presidentially appointed U.S. attorney under President Obama. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've served in the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, and then the Obama administration. So I've seen kind of how the Justice Department conducts its business in under different parties of administration, and really has seen how, you know, in the way the Justice Department works, it's completely removed from partisan politics and political pressures. And there's really some incredibly important reasons that that's so.
Well, I mean, that was always my impression, is that basically the justice system is supposed to be kind of politically sacrosanct or something. You know, they're just, yeah, ne'er the twain shall meet, basically. And Why is that, in your estimation, and maybe if you sort of can point to traditions from our, you know, our Constitution or sure. federal law and stuff, why is it so important for the Justice Department to be unaffected by politics?
That's an excellent and incredibly important question. Our democracy functions with the basis of certain incredibly important institutions. You know, a lot of this is from our grade school civics, frankly. But the justice system and the fair operation of the justice system is incredibly important bedrock to our system, which is based on rule of law and not on arbitrary direction by an autocratic dictator. We really need a justice system to be the one to manage the conflict between individuals and their government and make sure that people's rights ultimately are protected, and also that the public's interest prevails according to law. So, you know, one of the key players in that is our Justice Department. And a lot of times people don't think about it in this way and in this kind of detail. But it's incredibly important that the Justice Department, when it acts in its role representing the people of the United States in our justice system, act in a way that is perceived to be completely fair and unbiased by any kind of improper considerations, such as favoritism to one political party or one individual or one group of people. Otherwise, people don't have the ability to trust that what's going on and what's being represented to them of what's going on in the justice system is true and correct. And so the Justice Department has a very long, honored tradition of being removed from politics and protected from politics and insulated from politics and acting as a completely non-political agent in this process.
Now, I know that in some other countries, they're kind of famous for their own versions of the Justice Department sort of carrying out the political whims of the people in power. And I thought that, I don't know, 10 or 15 months ago, there was some discussion from our current president of the United States that those countries were, I won't use the full word, but something like S-holes.
Well, he has used a pejorative, I'm not sure, in relation to their judicial systems, but the comments you made about how other countries' judicial systems operate, unfortunately, are true. And really, one of the hallmarks of our system, one of the hallmarks that has made our system and our country the envy of the world, is the free and independent operation of our judicial system. That any citizen can go into a court in this country and be ensured that they're going to have their rights protected by, in a federal court, an Article III judge, with appellate procedures all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and also that they're going to have a government who is operating in a way that isn't directed by some autocratic whim and is conducting itself in a way that is fair and unbiased. Those are two kind of parallel and related actors, the courts and the Justice Department, that are incredibly important to ensuring that people think the system is fair. And it is so important that people understand and believe and trust that the system is fair. That's why it gets support. That's why the decisions made by our courts are viewed as legitimate, because they're not seen as autocratic and at the whims of somebody who is just making things up to favor a particular party. They're seen as things rooted in law and reason and ultimately controlled by the people through their democratic process of electing representatives and enacting laws and so forth.
So along comes Roger Stone. He is a longtime political player. He was a member of a lobbying firm in Washington, along with Paul Manafort, whose name is familiar to many people who followed the Trump administration. Paul Manafort is also a convicted felon now, and Roger Stone was involved in the effort to work with WikiLeaks before the 2016 election. Of course, WikiLeaks was breaking into the Democratic Party's email server and essentially trying to damage the Clinton campaign and Sure enough, that campaign ended up losing the election. I think a lot of us are quite familiar with his story, but Mr. Stone's role was, he seemed to be in the thick of it and ends up being convicted in November of 2019, just a couple of months ago, of these seven counts. The let's see here. During the 2016 campaign, Stone was accused by Hillary Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta of having prior knowledge of the publishing by WikiLeaks of Podesta's private emails obtained by a hacker. Stone tweeted before the leak, "It will soon the Podesta's time in the I think he meant B Podesta's time in the barrel." 5 days before the leak, Stone tweeted, "Wednesday, Hillary Clinton is done." WikiLeaks. And so, you know, he was in this game very much, and ends up essentially being convicted of seven different crimes, and gets this 7 to 9 year sentence. I don't know if you've ever seen a case like this, but somebody emailed me just a little bit ago and said the average sentence for rape is 4 years, and he thought it was outrageous that Stone was getting 7 to 9 years for these political crimes, basically. Do you have any sense of
I can speak to how the process works, and I think that's an important part of this for people to understand. In the federal system, there are these things called the federal sentencing guidelines, which are kind of an elaborate grid system that calculates a defender's criminal past and all sorts of facets about their conviction. If they stole money, how much money they stole. If they sold drugs, how much drugs they sold. If they used a gun, that's factored in. If they obstructed justice by trying to threaten witnesses or destroy documents or something like that, that's factored in. And you come up with, using this elaborate system, which is, by the way, developed by a bipartisan commission of sentencing experts, including a number of our top judges, and they come up with this guideline system, and those control the sort of default sentencing process for all types of crimes and all sorts of categories throughout the country. The idea being that, you know, the basic sentencing should not be just left up to the free whims of 800 different judges throughout the country. There should be some guidelines that give them some kind of direction. Mm-hmm. And so the guidelines point out to a suggested range to the judge. And the judge, under certain circumstances, is free to deviate from that range, but that's kind of the default range. And a very high portion of sentences fall within that range. And typically, the Justice Department is required, and under its own policies, requires itself to advocate for a sentence within that sentencing guideline range, unless there's some sort of very unusual factors that come into play. In the Stone case, and first of all, no, I've never seen a case like the Roger Stone case. I think it's safe to say that's a significant one-off kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. For a lot of reasons, you know, not the least of which is the kind of a case that it goes to the heart of our democracy by dealing with a significant threat to our election system. Okay, so that's not a common sort of a crime. Mm-hmm. That being said, the guidelines do take into account the nature of his crime, and they came up with a guideline range. The federal prosecutors, four career prosecutors who are assigned to the case, were advocating, and presumably, and we don't know all the details of this, presumably, though, with the blessing of at least the U.S. attorney in the Washington, D.C. district, presidentially appointed U.S. attorney, they were advocating for the default sentence within the sentencing guideline range. And so that would be kind of what one would expect to get. And 7 to 9 months under the guideline range is what they thought, and presumably their supervisors, at least initially, thought was the appropriate sentence. According to news reports, it appears that the Attorney General inserted himself into the process, and it's a little unclear, I guess, about whether that was done before or after the president's tweets complaining about how ridiculously high the sentence is, and suddenly the sentence was changed. That, to me, is extremely unusual. I would say, you know, never happens. In 12 years of my work as a line assistant under the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, I never had that happen in one of my cases. I never saw that happen in any of my peers' cases. I never heard that happening in any cases anybody else had done. During my time as the United States Attorney, that similarly never happened. You know, it's not to say, though, that supervisors and the Attorney General is ultimately the top supervisor in the Justice Department, don't have reasons and legitimate reasons to play some role in sentencing. But those rules have to be reviewed, done and used and reviewed based on the facts and circumstances of the case that are, you know, carefully and conscientiously considered and are completely removed from pressures from political considerations or politicians or the president. So there is a role for a supervisor to play in making a recommendation for a sentence, but it has to be done for the right reasons. And then even if it is done for the right reasons, you have this whole separate huge problem that if it's done in a with a timing such that it looks like it's political or raises questions in the part of the public that it's political, or the president weighs in and says, do this, and suddenly that appears to be driving the decision, then people begin to question the system, and you've raised the appearance of an improper influence. And that in itself is so damaging to our system of justice because people don't know what's going on or why it's going on. And that's why politics in the ordinary course is completely removed from this process and why it's so important that it is.
Well, you know, I also noted that you mentioned witness tampering or obstruction of justice as sort of aggravating factors in these cases, right? When you're doing the sentencing recommendation?
Yes.
And two of the convictions here, one was for obstructing an official process, and then the other was for witness tampering. So it seems like they'd be right in the wheelhouse here for aggravating the increasing the sentence
they
rather
do,
than reducing
and,
it.
And I believe for that enhancement, there was also conduct during the course of the trial that found that and the prosecution process that found that the obstruction enhancement was appropriate.
One of the things that I wonder about this Tristram Coffin is I don't know how many folks really have been keeping track out there, but as of mid-November, if my count is right, the various folks affiliated with Trump's campaign of 2016 and with his administration, you know, Michael Flynn and others who were involved in the campaign, obviously went on to serve at least briefly in the administration. And as of mid-November, the Trump administration had racked up 27 criminal convictions, which strike me as a pretty good measure because these are not just indictments. They're not just accusations by, politically motivated, perhaps, House of Representatives. They are actually items which have gone through the judicial process in this allegedly independent judiciary and have produced a finding of facts and concluded that, yes, indeed, this crime was committed either through a guilty plea or sometimes through a jury verdict. And first off, do you think that's a decent measure of sort of the relative criminality of maybe various presidential administrations or whatever, just how many criminal convictions they've had?
Well, I think it's a notable and important, very important statistic. You know, one should be careful about tarnishing with too broad a brush the conduct of others from people who've gone through the process and been convicted. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that's important. One thing that's also important, though, is to notice that, yes, they went through that process and they either pleaded guilty, admitted what they did, mm-hmm. Was in violation of law, or they presented their case to a jury of 12 citizens under our process, which is the envy of the world for its fairness and thoroughness, with full appellate review. And the juries convicted them after the evidence was presented to them. So that's no small thing, obviously, for those individuals. However, I would say that one should be careful about extrapolating about sort of broader criminality of groups based on individual convictions.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's a fairly blunt instrument or broad brush, as you put it, but I do think it's worth noting, for instance, just that if you went criminal convictions per month in a presidential administration, I think I got out my calculator a couple weeks ago and I figured out that the Trump administration actually is slightly ahead of Richard Nixon The Nixon administration had, I believe, 55 criminal convictions attributed to it, and the Trump administration, of course, in office for like half the time, I believe, had 27 as of mid-November. The per month rate was just slightly higher than in the Nixon administration. Should anybody make note of that or care about it?
Well, yeah, I think people do, and I think people will. And people are judging this president all the time with regard to how he chooses to conduct business, the people he brings into his office, and what he does. And I think in November there will be, you know, a significant calculation of the importance of the statistics that you just raised, and as well as many other factors that people will consider. And that's our system.
Yeah, I think the 27 convictions just kind of fascinate me, really, as an artifact of something. I'm not sure exactly how you, but again, these are things where they have gone through this process that, as you describe, is traditionally considered the envy of the world, which is the U.S. justice system, this email correspondent earlier today was talking about all of this as a nothing burger, this Roger Stone stuff. Would you regard it as a nothing burger?
No, and 2 points that I want to raise, sort of kind of on top of the things we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
One is, while I said that there's an appropriate role for supervisory.
Excuse me one second, Mr. Coffin. I hate to do this, but we've got to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News and a couple words for our sponsors. Can you stay with us through the break and be continuing our conversation afterward?
Happy to.
Okay, great. We'll be back shortly, folks. We are going to go to some CBS News Minute and a couple more words from sponsors. We'll be back very shortly.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks, from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont, the almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, continuing into our second half hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM and AM. And my guest is Tristram Coffin, former U.S. attorney in the state of Vermont, and headed up that federal prosecutor's office. I think went to work most days in Burlington. Is that right?
That's right.
And I know you have a presence. Isn't there a federal courthouse down in Brattleboro and one in Rutland too? Or
yeah, Brattleboro and Rutland are the other main federal court locations. Although Brattleboro's on the verge of winding down.
Oh, I see. Okay, tell me. We were talking just before the break. I was sort of asking you about, you know, how seriously should people view the situation surrounding Roger Stone and his offenses? This email correspondent earlier today was arguing that it's a nothing burger, and you were saying it wasn't for two reasons, and then I had to go to a break. So
yeah, sure.
Let's get back to your
thanks.
Two reasons.
So the two reasons on top, or that flow from the things we talked about a little bit earlier, are these. While it is appropriate for supervisors to have some say in what a sentencing recommendation should be, as I mentioned earlier, it needs to be done for kind of the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And politics is never the right reasons. And the problem we have here is, from the exterior appearance, the public's left really wondering whether it was a proper reason or an improper reason. And the president's tweet along these lines, and his own personal involvement with this particular defendant, and an implication in the conduct, shall we say, raises those kind of questions. And to my mind, something that the public should really look at here about whether this was just a normal supervisory decision with an appearance of politics, or whether there really was something wrong here, is the fact that four line federal prosecutors, longtime employees of the Justice Department, very experienced prosecutors, all resigned en masse after this was done. That says to me that's a real tell to the public, and the public should pay close attention to that, because that says that all is not right in River City on that. The other really important point that flows from all of this that we haven't really gotten into, but it's incredibly important, is the attacks that the president is making on the federal judge who's going to be sentencing this individual.
Because Amy Berman Jackson.
Yes, Judge Jackson. Because, you know, just as it is incredibly important that the Justice Department not be politicized and subject to political pressure, as important and perhaps even more so is the independence of the judiciary. And when you have the head of the executive branch making these sort of routine public assaults on the credibility and integrity of the judiciary, the public's left wondering whether they can trust the judiciary. It's left wondering whether the judiciary is going to bend to the will of this president, whether appointees that this president makes to the federal bench are going to be people who will listen to this president, or they're you know, sort of the Obama judges, as President Trump some time ago referred to them. And it's incredibly important for people to go into their courtroom thinking that the judge is going to take their case and listen to it fairly, and not whether it's a rich person or a poor person judge or a Democratic judge or a Republican judge, but it's a judge who's going to apply the law and the facts to the circumstances and do so in an incredibly fair manner. And that is just a bedrock important institution in our republic.
You know, I find this just kind of amazing and frankly almost worth smacking one's forehead and going, holy, you know what? Because this president really has, I mean, people talk about him having no guardrails or no boundaries or whatever, but it used to be kind of comforting to think, at least for me, and I think a lot of other Americans, that we had this system of checks and balances in our federal government. And if all of a sudden we just saw last week that the Congress really isn't an effective check on misconduct by the President of the United States. And we're seeing that this one other entity out there, which could be a break, that being the Justice Department and or the judiciary, the idea that if you really misbehave, you might end up in criminal trouble. Now we're full on attacking that entity as well. How loudly should alarm bells be going off in America right now, Tristram Coffin?
Well, I think your concerns are well taken, and I think the points you made are very well said, frankly. And I don't think we need to be alarmist about it, but I think that the limitations on power in our government and the arbitrary use of power against our citizenry, stemming from the founders and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, mm-hmm. and the unique drafting of our Constitution with checks and balances, is the envy of the world. And you've seen very few countries that have been able to have as functional and successful democracies or societies in the world, largely because of the unique design of our Constitution with checks and balances. This is all, fifth grade, civics lesson stuff.
Yeah,
but it's
yeah.
incredibly bedrock important. And I worry that in our busy lives, when we're all running around kind of doing what we need to do to get through the day, we can sometimes lose attention to those incredibly important principles. And this is a time that we really need to pay close attention to them, I would say.
By the way, you mentioned that judges are maybe even more sacrosanct than the Justice Department here. Nancy Gertner, a former federal judge, retired now, talked about Trump's comments in advance of this Stone sentencing. She said, "The timing is outrageous, and the notion that you're attempting to influence a judge." This is in response to particularly to Trump's tweets about Judge Jackson. And, I think we're into some very dangerous territory here. Let's bring in a caller or two. Forbes is on the line from Corinth. Let's go to Forbes.
How are you today?
Doing well. How are you, Forbes?
Good. Kind of expanding on the legal process.
Mm-hmm.
If accusations used for investigations were found to be false or illegal, how does this affect the process?
Let me go to Tristram Coffin on that. I think what you're going to, Forbes, tell me if I'm wrong, but there have been allegations that the initial asks for in the evidentiary collection process back very early in the Russia investigation were somehow untoward, and therefore, what, everything that follows should go away?
Well, there's a lot of factors involved, dossier, various other things, but mm-hmm. quite a few things that still haven't been answered and still in the air.
Yeah.
How, as I say, if any of these were found illegal or not proper, how would that affect the ending process?
Yeah, let's let Mr. Coffin weigh in.
Sure. You know, throughout the process, the defendant has all kinds of rights. The defendant is allowed to get discovery, subpoena any witnesses the defendant wants to bring, testify or not testify. They have all those rights. Once they put those rights into play, there's a trial, and the judge is there to apply the rules. And based on the rules, evidence is admitted or excluded. And if evidence is indeed illegally obtained and is relevant, and the government seeks to introduce it, it will not be admitted if it's illegally obtained, typically. There are rules that govern that. If the judge makes a decision, admitted or not, then the case that is presented to the jury, the defendant has a right to present their case or not to present a case. They have no obligation to present a case. The government has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And then the jury, under the Seventh Amendment, is required to make a decision of the facts. From there, the defendant has rights to appeal any legal decisions that are made. And that process should be the one that takes up and deals with the considerations that you're raising here. If for some reason somebody gets convicted and they get sentenced and, you know, a while later there is found that there was a legal defect in their case, and that does happen sometimes, and you've seen that in news articles sometimes, there is a process to have the sentence challenged on conviction, on post-conviction relief. And sometimes that does happen too. So there's a lot of protections, I would say. And you know, my sense is there's a lot of media talk in certain quarters about things that were done that were not correct and were illegal in collection of evidence, and it's a lot of loose talk. And the way that loose talk gets specifics put on it is through the specific trial process, where the rules of evidence are applied by an independent judge, and the defendant has certain rights, and the government has certain obligations, and it goes through that process.
If I recall correctly, this also was reviewed by the Justice Department's Inspector General, who produced a report on it. This question about the FISA warrants, how the FISA warrants were obtained, and so on. This is again very early in the Russia investigation. You know, even before Mueller was on the scene, if I recall correctly. And then you have to ask yourself, or anybody looking at this should ask, if Roger Stone is doing something illegal in connection with WikiLeaks, or if he's doing witness tampering in the course of a trial, you know, which is what he ended up being one of the seven things he ended up being convicted for, or if he's lying to investigators, five of the counts were for lying to investigators. You know, at what point does that behavior become irrelevant to any underlying flaw in the initial warrant?
I think those are excellent points, and you know, really go to the point that I was making as well, that there are rules about the type of evidence and the circumstances that evidence is gathered that can be admitted at trial. And once those rules are applied by the independent judge, there's these checks on that judge's authority to make sure the judge is applying them fairly, mm-hmm. up through conviction and sentencing. And then even after sentencing, if somehow there's find there was something improper that infected the process. But, you know, like you're alluding to, just because there was a mistake in a FISA application involving a totally different defendant, that doesn't exonerate somebody for offenses that are not connected to that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could say if that's what set off the Mueller probe, that initial FISA warrant, and the FISA warrant was faulty. Remember, the Inspector General found that while some of the conduct by the folks in the FBI was not the best, it was also not fatal even to the case that was targeted here. So, the bottom line here is the initial investigation did pass muster, according to the Inspector General, even though and to your point, Tristram Coffin, this all of this is appealable. I'm not sure. I've lost track. Has the initial warrant been appealed? Have charges been attempted to be thrown out based on, fruit of the poison tree or something like that?
There's been a number of attacks on the indictments in the Stone case, but particularly the Manafort case, mm-hmm. and those were found to be not a legal basis to warrant dismissal of the indictment.
Okay. Forbes, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Diane in Burlington. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. I'm glad you mentioned separation of powers, because I've been wanting to hear that for a long time, I foolishly said to my dad, the executive branch is supposed to attack the Congress and all that, because of that separation of powers. And I'm using attack a different way, but I really get frustrated with the lack of defining our terms and being specific. I remember it really started with that quid pro quo thing.
Yeah.
I think it keeps being used over and over,
mm-hmm.
and not defined, and a lot of people probably are asking Alexa or somebody,
Siri, what's a quid pro quo? Yeah.
Right.
I hope people, if they're interested in learning, they do a little more deep research than that, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just looking for more definition of terms, because it's the public is out there trying to listen. And
well, give me a term. What do we need to define better, Diane?
Quid pro quo.
Okay.
For instance, and also the Justice Department. I went all through my Constitution looking for it, and I didn't find it. Which branch is it in?
Tristram Coffin, let's talk about the origins of the Justice Department briefly. If I remember, there was, in the initial cabinet, there were like four members. One was a Secretary of War, and there was a Secretary of the Treasury, and there was a Secretary of State, and wasn't there also a Department of Justice, or am I misremembering
that? I believe that the Justice Department was not one of the original agencies.
What was the fourth one then? I'm trying to remember.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I didn't know there was four, but I believe the Justice Department was a creation later on, because there was not kind of federal criminal law at that point.
Uh-huh.
And that all came on post-Civil War, and the evolution came from there. But historically, it's incredibly important to understand that given the power the Justice Department wields, it has been seen as always incredibly important to keep it politically independent. So it's being exercised without fear or favor towards any particular party, and acting fairly in its realm. And then the other thing I wanted to say is this. The caller mentioned how the separation of power, she understood to mean that the executive branch should always be attacking the Congress.
Well,
I'd like to just refine that just a tiny bit. Maybe even this is more what you mean. The separation of powers in our system requires there to be a healthy tension to limit the powers of one branch by another. And while there is that, what I'm calling a healthy tension, in the normal course, it is not productive, I believe, to our democracy for one branch to be attacking another in a sort of violent way intended to overcome the other branch.
Like SDS did. Where democracy is nothing if not dangerous, right?
Right. And what I would say is, it's really important for the branches, while exerting their power and not being shy about imposing the strictures of their power, to be respectful of the powers of the other branches. Because it's really important for our system for all three branches to be vital and working and respected and doing their jobs. And there always are times, and this is the genius of our framers, there are times where those branches are going to bump into each other. But those bumps should not be so violent or as much of an attack kind of a feel as they are now. And, you know, you see an executive branch now that is unwilling to have, what would be called normal correct congressional oversight, is often attacking the judiciary. And it feels like we are not in sort of normal times here. And it would be, ideal for everybody. And I bet you, our citizenry would all feel much more comfortable if we were in a situation where the branches were respectful of each other, because it makes it easier for them to do their jobs.
The system working really depends on the behavior of the people within it, I think, is the bottom line here. We have another, we have another caller on the line. That is Paul from Moncton. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hey, I can't disagree with anything you guys have said. I'm full agreement with you for the most part. But one thing I would comment on is that there seems to be this impression that this is somehow something new. And I would disagree with that to the extent that maybe it's supersizing, which is pretty much what everything Donald Trump does. But if you go back in history and you look at Iran-Contra, you look at under the Obama administration, Fast and Furious, you look at the IRS scandals, the reality is in almost every one of the instances, including going back to Nixon, all documents have been held and withheld from being looked at, and testimony has been withheld. And, there's been discrepancies in probably illegal actions by many, many administrations. And furthermore, I would say the idea that somehow Americans are losing faith in the, in particular in the government and or the justice, I find that almost laughable, because the minorities have been screaming for decades about how they get treated here in this country, and conservatives too, mostly to the extent that they've argued that liberal judges tend to want to interpret the Constitution as opposed to actually just interpret the law and not the Constitution. The Constitution is this government, this document that is what it is and is not meant to be changed over time. I don't necessarily agree with that 100%, but I think there's more to this. I think it's been going on for a long time, and hopefully moving forward, this will put other presidents on notice that if they attempt this sort of thing, we're going to stop it.
Trish from Coffin, I'm interested in getting your thoughts. I mean, lots of stuff has been going on for a long time. Should we just give up and stop pointing it out when it happens?
Well,
bank robberies have been happening.
No, we shouldn't. One and two, I think it's really the reason I agreed to do this show, David, with you is because I do think this is a different level of concern, and the actions of this president with regard to his attempting to make it public that he's weighing in on the sentencing of his crony who's been convicted under our process for serious crimes that go to the heart of our democracy, crimes that may have some implication with him involved, is, to my experience, unprecedented, as is the unilateral resignations of the four prosecutors handling this when the Justice Department changed its position. And so you can say there's always been different kinds of investigations and even criminal convictions in different administrations. Oh, no one was convicted for Fast and Furious, for example. Mm-hmm. And David, you checked off some of the statistics with this administration. So, you can say that things have always been the same, and if you look at it with a broad enough lens, you can say that. But I worry that that broad a lens is going to miss some really important things that are going on here, and I think it's a really important time for the public to pay attention to the details here.
Yeah, I mean, the details can always be swept away in a wave of saying that, hey, this kind of stuff has been going on forever. But again, I think that anybody's ever been in the business of prosecuting crimes, as you have been, Tristram Coffin, knows that just because certain types of crimes recur in our society over time doesn't mean you stop trying to enforce the laws against them, I would think. Am I right about that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, hey, we are fast running out of time here on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. Tristram Coffin, former U.S. attorney in Vermont, I really want to thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we are going to be going to some top of the hour CBS News here, a couple words from our sponsors, and then on to the second part of the Dave Graham Show. We're going to be talking about horses in Vermont. A little change of topic there, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra, long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program this morning. We are going to be talking with Steve Dorsey of CBS News about these latest developments involving Roger Stone. I think also we may touch on an interesting story relating to immigration policy in the state of New York and in the country at large. Steve Dorsey, thanks for joining me this morning.
Hey, it's great to talk to you.
Hey, so tell me a little bit, first off, about what are the latest developments in this Roger Stone controversy?
Well, there's been a lot of pressure on Bill Barr to talk to lawmakers in Congress who have been critical of the president, saying he's tried to intervene in the Justice Department. And it all comes after these four prosecutors withdrew from Stone's case. And the president, of course, defending Bill Barr, what he called taking charge of a case that was slanted against Roger Stone.
And the sentencing guidelines, from what I understand, when you're talking about somebody who is alleged or is convicted now of committing witness tampering, for instance, or obstruction of process, that is actually something which would tend to enhance a sentence, right?
Yeah, of course. I think by some measures, perhaps this was an appropriate sentence. Remember, this is just a sentencing recommendation. It's up to the judge to determine the sentencing. Mm-hmm. Others have criticized the sentence for being too harsh, among those the president and his closest advisors. The White House says either way, the president, as the chief law enforcement officer for the federal government, has the right to criticize this, although the president said he didn't speak to the Justice Department directly. But obviously he's acting in a presidential statement sort of way on Twitter, and that puts pressure on the Justice Department to change his course.
And the president also taking aim at the judge, this Amy Berman Jackson, right?
Yeah, criticizing her. She's had a central role in acting as a judge in these cases connected to the Russia probe. She is a tough figure, that's for sure. And now that, you know, she's taking the president's latest criticism, that won't probably be the last time either.
You know, it just strikes me as kind of odd that one would criticize the judge before she makes her decision. You know, you might criticize afterward, but it's kind of like, you know, saying, "Hey, ref, you're going to blow the next foul call."
Well, you know, listen, she is not one to back away from fights, and she is praised for her toughness, and I don't think she'll back away from this fight either.
Really interesting set of developments here. I mean, this whole thing, it's sort of part of a piece, but also you just have to stand back and go, wow. Pretty unusual is the way, of course, I think it was marked by the withdrawals of these four. Are these withdrawals or resignations, or what is actually happening with these four individuals and the lawyers in the Justice Department?
Well, it's tough to tell. Democrats in Congress say they've resigned. However, the formal definition we'd be getting from the Justice Department is they've just withdrawn themselves from the case. Had they been working on that case full time? Likely. So what does that mean for their working status at the Justice Department? I think it's still unclear.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, I guess one question, just in the matter of sort of workplace policies, can you do that? You know, I mean, I've worked in newsrooms in the past, and if I suddenly went to my editor and I said, "Hey, I want to withdraw from the story,"
I'm withdrawing from work.
Yeah, exactly. I would kind of get, really? You think so? You know,
right.
Or whatever. You know, and
The Justice Department hasn't been saying much, I should say. They haven't been responding to these president's statements. We haven't heard Attorney General Bill Barr say a whole lot, but perhaps that could change.
Well, okay. Let's shift gears really quickly. I know you don't have much time, but I did want to ask you about this case of in New York State where apparently there's some disagreement over sharing of DMV records with the federal immigration authorities by the state. Is Cuomo going to give in on this?
Huh. Well, I mean, Cuomo and Donald Trump have not seen eye to eye in quite a long time. And they're meeting today at the Oval Office later this afternoon. We don't expect to see that meeting play out, although it's possible they could decide to open that up. But, you know, the president has been tough on accusing states like New York and cities like New York City of being sanctuary cities, of protecting illegal immigrants. And this is one way they hope to leverage them into doing more work with federal immigration authorities.
Really interesting. I mean, the question is, of course, the degree to which the states are being asked to sort of deputized to carry out Trump administration immigration policy with which they may quite strongly disagree. Historical precedent here might be the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which I know in Vermont's case up here, Vermont basically refused to participate. That, of course, was a federal law saying that when slaves escaped to the North and they were captured up here, they had to be sent back to their owners in the South. Vermont said, we're not playing that game. And there are some folks up here we've had similar controversies in our state about the degree to which the state is going to carry out or participate in federal immigration policy. And some folks I've heard say there's a little parallel here. I don't know whether that's really the case, but it's a kind of an interesting history lesson that you get in the process of wondering about that. So,
yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, is that relevant to modern history? You know, probably not. But that's what the White House could be pointing to.
So, all right. Well, hey, Steve Dorsey, I thank you very much for joining me this morning.
It's great to talk to you, as always.
All righty. I think the worst mixed metaphor in the history of radio got uttered by yours truly just before the break when I talked about we were going to shift gears and talk about horses. And then I got off the air and I went, wait a minute, are these horses a standard or an automatic? Dana, you're an old car guy. What do you want to tell us about that? I don't know.
Continuously variable transmissions.
Yeah, there we go. Wow. Okay, well, I really have to put on a whole new kind of, I don't know what,
helmet.
A riding helmet. There we go. That's what I should do. Put on a riding helmet. That was the voice of Heidi Krantz, who was a guest of mine this morning. She's in our studio. Heidi is from Craftsbury. She's the president of the Vermont Horse Council. It's a volunteer nonprofit, puts on an industry summit, and works with the state and nonprofits to maintain amenities such as riding trails at Groton State Forest. The Vermont Horse Council has a mission of promoting and protecting the interest of all Vermont horsemen and women. And there you go. So, Heidi Krantz, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Happy to be here.
And also, I believe we have on the phone with us Chrissy Rohan. She is a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Veterinary Sciences at the University of Vermont. She's been there since 2016. Her responsibilities at UVM include teaching equine management and training classes, as well as overseeing the Ellen A. Hardacre, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Equine Center, which is home to several equine educational activities at UVM. She's been working with horses for over 30 years. And Chrissy Rohan, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And I must say, if either of you want to make fun of me or razz me for that bad mixed metaphor before the break there, you're more than welcome to jump in here and go, Dave, what the heck are you doing? The other thing I wanted to mention was that this is our regular Thursday, second hour of the Thursday show. I always devote to something we are calling our Seeds to Society segment. It's put on in collaboration with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and they have been a terrific help to me personally just by helping me think up good topics and guests for this series of segments we've been doing every Thursday, and I'm really feeling good about the UVM Cal's folks and the fact that they are able to get some good radio time on WDEV here. This is going great, if you ask me. I hope the listeners agree. I hope the Cal's folks agree. And anyway, let's get into talking some horse sense here. Heidi Krantz, the Vermont Horse Council, has been around for how long?
We were organized back in 1975, and so since then have been representing equestrians and equestrian businesses in the state of Vermont. And in recent times, we've been really trying to focus on how to learn more about the equine industry and community in this state, because information really hasn't been gathered since about 2003 or four, when the last time any kind of surveying was done.
Wow, and the so would. If I were to ask you what's the current landscape of the Vermont equine industry, it's a little bit hazy, it sounds like.
It's somewhat hazy. I think those of us that are out there every day mucking stalls probably have some thoughts and views about it. But in general, I would say it's reasonably healthy. It's got some challenges facing it. But if you drive around the state of Vermont, it doesn't take long before you pass a house with horses in the backyard and or to see in certain areas of Vermont, places with large barns and equestrian centers. Therapeutic riding programs have become very popular in this state. So there's a lot going on.
Therapeutic riding programs. I know of one such organization in the Champlain Valley, and they're working with young people who maybe have had some troubles in their lives and so on and so forth, and getting them to ride horses and work with horses. And horses just seem to be a great way for especially young people, I think, people of any age really, but to kind of relate to this other living thing, which is not judging you at all.
But you
have to work with it and develop a relationship. That's got to be a helpful thing in certain contexts.
It certainly is. And Chrissy, please jump in with this. But horses are very sensitive animals, and they're strong mirrors of our own emotional situations in particular. So that's one of the reasons why they work so well in a therapeutic situation. But they also provide a lot of physical therapy, because the motion of riding a horse, the motion of the horse's walk and movement is very relaxing and can really help with people who have muscular issues or nervous system issues.
Wow. Chrissy, in your work as a lecturer at the Department of Animal and Veterinary Sciences at UVM, do you get into this much, into the realm of kind of horse, relations with, how horses and people relate to one another and the therapeutic aspects of it, et cetera?
To a certain degree. One of the courses I teach, the students help take care of the horses that we use in the animal science program, and so a lot of those students haven't had any experience with horses, so they have to learn about the horse's behavior and how to interact with them in a safe way. And I just wanted to add, just in terms of horses as using them for therapy, horses aren't judgmental, and I think that makes them a really safe vehicle to provide therapy. And then also there's an aspect of mindfulness when you're riding them, or even working with them, you really need to be focused on the horse and what's happening in that moment. And there's no opportunity to have your mind wander to other issues.
Yeah, I would think that mindfulness part of it is vital, because after all, you don't want to be maybe have your back turned or whatever when the horse decides to kick or something. That could sometimes result in a less fun experience with the situation. And Chrissy, in terms of the economic impact and the way that horses are featured in the Vermont agricultural economy and so on, I know there are a number of trail and horseback riding events in the state. Do you folks involve yourselves in the sort of circuit of those?
In terms of the university or the just in general? Well, I personally, outside of UVM, have students that compete in Vermont. So they compete on the Vermont Hunter Jumper Association circuit. And then we also compete down in Dorset at the Vermont Summer Festival. And we are involved with activities at Green Mountain Horse Association. And I think it's really valuable to my position at the university to have connections with various horse organizations and businesses and professionals in the state, because I'm able to connect students who have an interest in equine related careers, like I'm able to connect them with those people in the state.
Mm-hmm. And Heidi, let me ask you the same question. Your organization, the Vermont Horse Council, are you a presence at, for instance, the Summer Festival? I don't really recall its exact name, but down in Dorset, I know there's a big event every summer.
Yeah, that's probably the largest equine event that's held. It lasts over about 6 weeks long, and has huge economic impact in that region. We don't have direct involvement with it or with any particular event. Our role is more to help promote those events in general and to support the efforts of any organizations or businesses to offer those kinds of opportunities for people to either show or come up to go on trail rides or to take advantage of equine opportunities in our state.
Yeah, I've always kind of admired horses from afar. I think you can probably tell by my questions so far that I am not an equestrian myself. But I have ridden horses, probably a half dozen times in my life or something like that, or tried to, and I do find them to be pretty fascinating animals, and the whole sort of horse world to be a fascinating topic. And I'm just I'm wondering, is there any there isn't really any specific like horse racing in Vermont that you think of, the Preakness and the Kentucky Derby and all that stuff. We don't have that here.
We don't have that level, but we do have the Morgan Trotting Races, which are an historic an event that happens. It's sponsored by the Vermont Morgan Horse Association, and it's based on races that were held here back in the 1700s and 1800s, featuring our Vermont state animal, the Morgan Horse. Mm-hmm. But others, it's a very popular spectator opportunity. They're held down in Brookfield. At one point, there were trotting tracks all across Vermont, and that was big entertainment before TV was an option for us. So yes, there is at least some forms of racing.
And the Morgan Horse is a. Tell me a little bit about the history there. What is it about the Morgan Horse in the state of Vermont? They are beautiful animals. I mean, a lot of people love them, but...
Yep, they are a beautiful animal, and they're... the tradition is that Justin Morgan was the first Morgan horse, and he is what's referred to as a foundation sire. And one of the reasons that he was so popular was that all of his offspring carried many of his strong characteristics, which were to be strong and fast and have great endurance, and to have a wonderful personality, which are among the characteristics that people value in the Morgan horse even today.
I'm reading that they were quite widely used as cavalry horses during the American Civil War, I guess because of their durability and general just strength and solidness.
Yes, exactly. They could carry tremendous weight for their size and go long distance and live on very little, so they made great mounts for that. And the UVM actually was very involved in doing a lot of research and breeding of those, and we still have an active cavalry in our state today.
So, Chrissy, given that you work with the University of Vermont, which, of course, has the university now runs the Morgan Horse Farm in Middlebury, I believe?
Weybridge.
Weybridge, yeah. Okay.
Yep.
And the Morgan Horse Farm is a place where, does a lot of your work happen there?
I work in conjunction with them. So I work mostly on campus in Burlington, but we work together for some of the courses that we offer, and we have more students going down to the Morgan Horse Farm for internships and research. And then also the Morgan Horse Farm has been bringing horses up to campus to use in some of my classes for teaching. And so trying to get the word out to students at UVM about the great opportunities there. And they also offer two reproduction workshops that are credited courses that UVM students or people outside of UVM can take.
Now, Heidi, I see here that the Vermont Horse Council put on a helped to put on a equine industry summit 4 years ago to ask people to express their concerns about the equine industry in Vermont. And I wonder if you know, is the equine industry, would you say, growing or is it shrinking or is it about, you know, people talk about the dairy industry shrinking in Vermont, although some of it is just consolidation into larger farms. But what about the horse industry? Is it holding its own?
Well, that's one of the reasons why we're doing these surveys, because we're not entirely clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the summit, the first summit was held back in 2017. And as a result of that, we want the participants in that survey who were equine professionals from across the state identified the need for an economic impact study as their top priority to help them as they try to assess their businesses and whether to try to grow and expand or what they needed to do. So, you know, anecdotally, I think you see a little bit of both. There are new opportunities coming in. We get calls for information from people who are looking to either grow their businesses or to build new equine facilities. At the same time, there are businesses that are closing and for sale. So it's a little bit of both. I've also recently seen a number of young people who grew up in Vermont who went away to school and have come back and either opened or purchased veterinary clinics, which to focus on the equine industry.
And are we in a situation where the veterinary clinics are? I think of, you know, when I go to the vet, I bring my dogs, and those are small. I think a small animal vet. What about large animals? Now we're talking about, is that something that is a growing field in Vermont, or are people having a harder time finding a large animal vet these days? Or
it depends on the area that you're in. You know, I live up in the Northeast Kingdom. Up until a year or two ago, we sadly lost a number of our equine veterinarians because they were older and getting ready for retirement. And but those are among the folks that have moved in and filled that gap, bringing young people back to Vermont. So that's one of the things I think is exciting. When we talk about losing young people in this state, the equine industry seems to be luring them back here or into our state. So that's kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also do have one large animal clinic that is located in Milton that you can bring your horse to for more extensive treatment.
I see. Okay. So
I just want to add on
sure.
a little bit.
Yep.
So the Department of Animal and Veterinary Science, we get many students who are come to this university to prepare for veterinary school. And it's a great, they have a great opportunity here in that they get hands-on experience with horses and with cows.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a need for more large animal vets in general in our country. I think a lot of people that go into becoming a vet look more at small animals.
Yeah. So, well, that is interesting. So it sounds like some of the students at UVM are, they see the world as their oyster almost. They have a lot of opportunity ahead. Is that fair?
Yes.
All righty. We are very shortly going to be going to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news and a couple of words from our sponsors. But I just wanted to before we do that, I wanted to tell folks out there that we are talking about horses in Vermont. It is a fascinating topic, I think. We're trying to get and it sounds like some of the organizations that deal with horses in Vermont are trying to get a better handle on what are the trends in the horse world here in our state. Chrissy Rowan is one of my guests. She's a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Veterinary Sciences at UVM. Heidi Krantz is the president of the Vermont Horse Council. And we'll be back to continue our conversation with these two folks. And welcome your calls at 244-1777 in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool Prana Smart Wool Save the Duck Kari Tra Long Underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We're back and we're continuing our conversation about horses in Vermont. And do we still have Fred on the line? I see a sign in my window saying that Fred had called in. Is he still on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good morning, Fred. How are you? Are you a horseman?
Well, I'm really not a horseman. I've been fascinated by horses. I had a chance to ride a stallion. It was a thoroughbred.
Uh-huh.
And I got up on top of the stallion, and it lasted about 1 minute and fell off.
Yikes! That must have hurt.
So anyway, my question is: Did your guest ever hear of the Sierra 100?
The Sierra 100. Heidi Krantz, what about you? Have you heard of the Sierra 100?
I'm not specifically, but I'm assuming that that's one of the many endurance rides that are offered across the country. There's one called the Tevis Cup. There's one right here in Vermont that's well known, the Vermont 100, that's based out of the Green Mountain Horse Association in South Woodstock. And there's different links that you can sign up to participate in, but the 100 is kind of the crown jewel, and they're very intense. You have to ride 100 miles in one day, and it requires a great bit of training beforehand to get your horse up to speed for it, so to speak, and there's vetting that happens during the course of it to make sure that the horse is in good shape, and if there's any issues, the horse and rider will be pulled. It's quite an event to watch.
Yeah, I was out in California on an equestrian trail going through the mountains, and I was above the horse coming up the trail, and I noticed that the man was riding the horse. He wasn't riding the horse. He was behind the horse, holding the horse's tail, and he got up to me, and we got to talking, and he says, "Yeah," he's telling me that this race is all about the horse. He says, "I'm training my horse. When my horse gets tired, he stops. I get off, and I go to his tail. I hold on to his tail. And then he'll continue to go. And then when he stops again, that means he's ready for me to get back on him." I don't know if he was telling me a story, but it was very interesting.
Huh.
No, that's a fairly common practice in those longer races, to give the horse a break, particularly in challenging territory and terrain. And but you have to stay connected with your horse. So that's the relationship between a horse and rider in those cases is generally a very strong bond.
Wow. And so I would imagine that the rider would have to be in pretty good shape too if they're scampering over rough terrain following the horse.
Yes, absolutely.
It was very interesting because he said it's an open race, meaning there's no handicap in it, and he was telling me the winners are usually women.
Well, what do you
because
know
they're lighter because they're lighter, they weigh less than men do.
Okay. Of course,
that was his excuse, maybe. I don't know.
That's an interesting comment because in the Olympics, the equestrian events are one of the only events where men and women compete against each other.
That's fascinating. It makes sense.
There's no handicap, right? I mean,
nope.
Even.
Yep, they compete evenly. Yep.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Yeah, so right. Anyways, the guy was into it. He was into it because he said it was a lot of fun, but he said he knew he never would have a chance of winning.
Well, sometimes it's, what is it, it's not whether you win or lose, it's the way you play the game or something like that. So,
yeah, I guess so.
Fred, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. So I am interested. What are some of the other, we mentioned this is the Green Mountain Horse Association's of Vermont 100,
mm-hmm.
The Dorset 6-week horse event. What is that called again? Do we
it's
know?
The Vermont Summer Festival.
The Vermont Summer Festival.
Yep.
Dorset.
Dorset. Yep.
What are some of the other leading events around the state? Are there others or are those the big two?
Green Mountain Horse Association also hosts something called the Festival of Eventing, and that draws people from all over the country to come there. And they also do a big dressage show as well.
Now, tell me if either of you know sort of how Vermont's horse industry and activities connected to it kind of stack up to our neighboring states. Is there more, or does it seem like there's more or less activity over New York State or New Hampshire, Maine, or is Vermont a leader here? What's the sense?
I would not say that we're a leader overall, because just we're a smaller state to begin with. And mm-hmm. when you're neighboring with states like New York, where there's a lot of racing, for one thing, and New York in particular, along with some of the states out west and down south, have a strong support of equine tourism. So that's one of the reasons why we're working on this economic impact study, is to get a sense for whether we can grow that part of the industry. The survey that we completed 2 years ago showed us that the equine events that we were able to survey brought in almost $22 million to the local economy. So there's potential there in this state for that kind of tourism. So we are trying to grow that, our relationship and our how we stack up with some of the other states.
Yeah, speaking of equine tourism, years ago, my family and I, being my wife and two sons, the four of us went out and visited friends in Montana. And because we're out west, we had to go on a horseback riding adventure up into the mountains in southwestern Montana. It was a lot of fun. We enjoyed the day. I tell you, we have a few pictures from that day, and it cracks me up whenever I look at them, because I could just look at myself and my wife and my two sons. None of us who had really any experience to speak of riding horses. And particularly my sons and I, we just don't look very natural in the saddle. I can just sort of look at it and go, oh, I don't know, what's the term, greenhorns or something, or you know.
So you were talking about just the competition side of things in the state. I think one of our hopes with the second phase of our economic impact study is that we're not even clear about like how many horses are in the state, and it's important to recognize that there's a wide range of like uses for the horses. So mm-hmm. we have, you know, show and competition horses, but then a lot of people just have pleasure horses. There's working horses, like in Bristol, there's a team of draft horses that go around and collect the trash.
Oh yeah.
And then there's the therapeutic riding programs that we mentioned before. There's breeding operations. And then there's also a number of equine rescues in the state as well. So there's a lot of different people working with horses and interacting with them.
We have a listener calling in. Let's go to Tom in Duxbury. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, I'm very good. Great program. Hey, just a local point of interest. My father, who is right next door over in Duxbury, is a pretty prominent horse racer at Saratoga and in the Northeast, and he's been active for 50 years. He's pretty impressive, and it's Saratoga's no small track. He's been Horseman of the Year there twice. He's in his 80s and still racing, so it's alive and well.
That's
horse racing.
That's pretty nifty. Are you a horseman yourself?
Not at all. Not at all. I was when I was younger, but I've on to other things. But horse racing is alive and well in the New York State. You know, it's they're pari-mutuel tracks where there's betting. So he was elected to the Agricultural Hall of Fame a couple of years ago in Vermont because of it. And Waterbury's rich in horse history. His family imported horses here into central Vermont via train. It's fascinating, really, if you look back at it.
Hmm. I should ask my buddy Dana here, our engineer, to get your name as you get off the phone and a number. I might like to interview your dad sometime about his work in horses.
I find out things about the Waterbury area, you know, in past years from talking to him that would blow your mind. It's hard to perceive. My uncle was big in the industry, in the horse racing industry, that is. And it's kind of died out in Vermont. You know, there's very, I think Rutland races a little, Tunbridge race, or I don't know if Barton still races, but it's very limited.
Yeah.
But,
yep.
you know, he raced in Blue Bonnets in Montreal, and it's impressive. You'd like it.
I want to hear more about it, but let's do it. I'll give you a call. Dana's going to get your phone number for me. I hope, and we can connect a little later. How's that sound?
So I want to just pick up on something that the caller just mentioned about his father being recognized by the Agriculture Hall of Fame, because horses are, they fall in sort of a gray area in terms of either being agriculture or being business. And we're hoping that with this study that we are able to work with that probably the Vermont Farm Bureau and the legislators to try and make some changes in the state in terms of that.
You know, that's interesting to me. In fact, the question popped into my head earlier, and then I neglected to pursue it with the two of you, which is that is there, you know, I think I framed it first, is there a point person at the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets, who basically sort of is oversees the horse industry, the equine industry in Vermont? Heidi?
No, there's not. We did, until a few years ago, have an equine specialist at the University of Vermont Extension Service, but sadly that position was let go, so we don't even have that. And we work closely with the Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets and the Farm Bureau, but again, that's, we're trying to strengthen that connection because it is an important one as the face of agriculture in Vermont changes. We feel that horses are playing a little bit more of a role in terms of, we talk about the working landscape, and horses in this state are still on pasture and still need to be fed hay. And a lot of farmers are finding that horse hay production is a nice additional piece of income for them as their dairy incomes are changing.
Let's bring in another caller, a listener on the line. Bambi from Morristown, I believe, is on the line.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. I just got in from the barn and started to hear your program. I don't know if you mentioned the vet. I heard something about the vets, but I want to tell a story. I was in desperate need of an emergency vet last winter in the cold, and I called my local vet, and he referred me to a vet in Burlington. And, I mean, that's like an hour's drive, and I needed somebody sooner. So he gave me the name of a Waterbury vet. And when I called him, he said, thanks for calling, but he only does horses. And then he gave me the name of a nice young lady from Middlesex. And she has a farm, an on-farm veterinarian service, and she arrived in 20 minutes from, I don't know, she has a pager, so she might have been closer, but I'll tell you, within 20 minutes she was at my farm, and she was driving a lab. I mean, she had one of these fancy Mercedes vans. It was all set up like a lab. I mean, she had everything she needed in there, electricity, water, you know, a whole supply of veterinarian tools. And she was a lifesaver for me. And I ended up having two beautiful twin lambs probably 10 days later when she said that they would come after she had vetted the ewe. So I just wanted to plug in that service. And she travels, you know, all over. But she has a paging service, so when you call the number, they give you the paging service, and she can come from wherever she is to where you are.
Well, it's good that you got that help that you needed. I'm glad that is the horse doing okay now?
Oh, these are sheep. I'm a shepherd.
Oh, I see. Okay.
and I was going to interject that system is fairly common with most equine vets and most, I think, rural vets, that they need to carry a great deal of equipment with them. They have an eclectic knowledge and skill base, and they do work together as much as they can to support those of us that live out in, especially in the more rural parts of the state. And it's a big investment. investment for them, which again ties back into trying to get more information about the expenses that people are incurring to maintain their animals, so that as people are considering growing their businesses or needing financing to expand their businesses, they have some data to use when they're applying for loans and trying to help their businesses grow to make that investment.
Heidi, I want to ask, and maybe Chrissy can weigh in on this afterward. I want to ask, do you ever feel like, I mean, given that there's no staff member at either University of Vermont Extension or at the State Agency of Agriculture devoted to Vermont's equine industry, I'm wondering, is there a sense in which horses are considered to be, I don't know, sort of a luxury or something that is not really that crucial to the overall scene out there in Vermont agriculture?
I think that there is a little bit of that, and to some extent an attitude or an impression that horses are a more elite sport or a sport of the wealthy. And I think we're all going to be surprised when we get this information back from this particular survey of Vermont horse owners. Certainly among the people that I mostly relate to with horses, they're sort of average people who've made the decision that having a horse is important enough to them that they do without other things. And so they're not necessarily in a high economic bracket, but they've chosen to own horses, and so I think it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out, and I'm hoping that also dispels the idea that we don't, as an industry, need help because we could take care of ourselves. The Vermont Horse Council, for example, is a nonprofit organization with an all-volunteer board. Most of the nonprofits that are related to the equine industry in Vermont are in a similar position. They have very small paid staffs, if they have any at all. And run very tight budgets, but do an amazing job trying to get the word out about the opportunities.
Sue from Randolph's on the line. Let's go to Sue. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for your guest. Hi, Heidi. I was at the president of the Vermont Horse Council many, many years ago, and I'm just curious. We had conducted a survey, and it sounds very similar to what you have been explaining. We worked in conjunction with UVM Extension and Betsy Green, who I'm thinking was who you just referred to as the position had been reduction in force. But anyway, I didn't hear any mention of it, and I'm wondering if the numbers that you pull from this next, you know, endeavor, if they will be compared to those that we did back 15, 20 years ago. It sounds like very similar to what we did back then.
Yes, we absolutely will be doing some comparison, although the study that we're undertaking now goes into a little bit more depth than that initial study, because we're actually gathering details about the expenses that individual owners are incurring, whereas the past study focused more on more primarily on demographic information about the horse industry. So we're trying to update that and expand it.
Got it. I think it's a very valuable tool to have here in Vermont. As you said, it's a huge industry that people just are not aware of what we spend on horses and how it brings people into the state. And just wanted to thank you for your work on the Vermont Horse Council. And I would like to say I'm extremely disappointed that UVM has, in the University of Vermont, has gotten rid of that equine specialist this position. It was valuable to us, but I guess that's the sign of the times. But thank you for what you do.
Thanks for the call, Sue.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, let me go to Chrissy on this. Chrissy, is there any indication that UVM might reinstate that position that we've talked about, or what's going on with all that?
I'm not sure. I don't know for sure if they would reinstate it. I think it's a good sign that Extension is back in the College of Agriculture and Life Science.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that in my interactions across the state, when I talk to people, Betsy Green's name comes up all the time, and people definitely miss having her or having somebody in that role in the state.
Yeah.
I think we're hoping that when we get some of the results from this study, that it might help towards promoting having that position come back.
Bring that idea back to the fore. Yeah. And perhaps somebody at the Agency of Agriculture down in Montpelier as well. I'm frankly kind of surprised there isn't somebody there. And maybe with Extension too, but I just think it struck me that, I think that there are people there, for instance, at Agency of Agriculture devoted to overseeing Vermont's hemp industry. Just as one example of something. We got Rich from Starksboro calling in. Good morning, Rich.
I got a question for your guests regarding horse enterprises. Of all of the horse enterprises that you're familiar with, they've got an idea. How many of them actually do break even or better from a financial accounting perspective? And that's with accurate accounting. Just kind of curious.
I don't have an answer to that, but again, anecdotally, I would say from the folks that I've spoken with, there are of course some that do well, and there are some that don't do very well. I think a lot of them struggle to make ends meet, and that's again part of the reason why we want to do this research. A number of the questions in our survey are targeting businesses to try to get some more of that information. All of the information that we're gathering is anonymous, so we don't know specifically which businesses it's coming from, so people shouldn't worry about that if they're taking it. But I'm hoping we'd be better able to answer that question after we get through with this part of the survey. It is a difficult industry, and Chrissy, you might have more information to share on that. It's a difficult industry to make ends meet because of that gray area that Chrissy mentioned earlier. Equine businesses are considered agricultural in some areas that particularly around regulations, but they don't get some of the same tax benefits that other agricultural businesses get.
And I just want to add to that, I mean, I guess anecdotally also, I think people struggle to break even. I think farms have to really think about how they can diversify their operation, whether they grow other crops as well as running the horse business or diversifying in terms of what services they offer at their farms.
All right. Well, I am very happy to have had these two guests, Heidi Krantz of the Vermont Horse Council, Chrissy Rowan from the Department of Animal Science at the University of Vermont, to join me this morning. Unfortunately, we are just running up on 11 o'clock here, which is the end of the Dave Graham Show. And the two of you, I'd like to thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Sure. And our Seeds to Society segment, remember, every Thursday, second hour of the show, between that 10 and 11 time block, is really a lot of fun if you're interested in food, agriculture-related topics. So we're going to go to the end of the show here. We're going to bring in Bill Sayer, Common Sense Radio, and we'll be back with another edition of the Dave Graham Show tomorrow, broadcasting live from the State House in Montpelier. Tune in around 9 tomorrow, and we'll talk to you all then. Have a great day.